Tantar Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Secrets of Worry Dolls by Amy Impelizzeri. Narrated by Elizabeth Liang. Author's note. On November 12, 2001, American Airlines Flight 587 crashed on my residential corner in Bell Harbor, New York. All the passengers and crew and five of my neighbors on the ground died that morning. All reports of that day say there were no survivors. But that is not true. Bell Harbor, a beautiful, scrappy, and resilient seaside town with a large population of New York City firefighters and rescue personnel, was left to pick up the pieces of this devastating event just 2 months after 9/11, the date on which the small town had lost over 70 of its own residents to the terrorist attacks. I was not supposed to be home on November 12, 2001, but as fate would have it, I had taken the day off from my Manhattan law office and awakened just in time to see the plane breaking apart over Bell Harbor before it crashed outside my front door. The emergency response team arrived moments later, many having just left a shift at Manhattan's Ground Zero, and commandeered my home for the recovery operation. They had no choice, really. My house was the only one of the four homes on the corner where the crash occurred that was not leveled or engulfed in burning jet fuel. All these years later, I am still horrified, grateful, guilty, and relieved to relay this fact. Secrets of Worry Dolls is entirely fictional, of course, including the plane crash it depicts. But it is still a deeply personal story for me. Its tale of resiliency and hope is the phoenix that arose from the ashes of that day's tragedy. And I would be remiss in not remembering publicly the victims of that day. And the survivors. At any given moment, you have the power to say that this is not how the story is going to end. Anonymous. Lou. When my sister, Ray, and I were about 6 years old, Mama gave us two packages wrapped in shiny paper that she said came from her home country of Guatemala, a place she rarely talked about at all. Inside the paper were some decidedly unshiny presents, small wooden boxes filled with tiny creatures woven in bits of red and green and blue thread. One box was painted entirely red, and one was still the natural color of the wood that shaped its box, save for a single blue stripe. Mama told us that the woven creatures were called worry dolls, and that we should whisper our troubles to them each night before bed. The worry dolls would do all the worrying for us and allow us peaceful sleep. I remember how she practically sang those words to us in her high, lilting voice, wrapped with her native accent. My sister and I took one look at each other and burst out laughing. Dolls to worry for you? That's ridiculous. And then we fought over who would get the red box. My sister won, of course. Up until the day Mama gave us those dolls, neither of us had given any thought about the need to place our worries somewhere. Indeed, neither of us had even thought to worry much at all at that point. But that was all about to change. Mama must have known that. Every time I look back on that day, those dolls, her gift to us, I can't help but think, as crazy as it sounds, and believe me, I do know how crazy our story sounds, that Mama must have known everything that was about to happen. Part 1. October 11, 2012, 71 days before the end of the world. Lou. Here's to missed chances, untold secrets, and regrets. The dark-haired woman next to me at the airport bar was holding up her glass at an alarming angle so dangerously close to me, it seemed my only two choices were to clink my glass on hers and continue the conversation, or invite a rather large splash from her drink into my lap.
If you say so, I conceded.
She put her drink down after our toast, and I thought maybe we were done. No such luck.
Well, you look too young to have any real secrets just yet, young lady. But you have time.
My bar neighbor smiled broadly and locked in on me with dark eyes that were outlined in thick makeup caking into deep creases. She smelled faintly of rose oil and olives and was dressed in a tweed skirt and jacket, suited for professional travel like most of the patrons in the bar that morning. I looked down self-consciously at my linen pants and lightweight sweater that gave me away as a misfit among the crowd.
You live in New York?
I nodded in response and offered, yes, in Rock Harbor, before clamming up again.
Where you headed?
She continued, undaunted by my silence. I thought I detected a slight slur. Maybe I was just being sensitive. I glanced over my shoulder back down the hallway at gate G12. My plane had departed without me about a half hour ago, and so her question wasn't an easy one. I glanced up at the television screen above the bar, hoping for a distraction, and found one.
Would you look at that?
I pointed up at the screen and felt relief when her thickly made-up eyes directed themselves away from me, finally.
The world is ending.
The Mayan so-called long-count calendar, which spans roughly 5,125 years starting in 3,114 BC, reaches the end of a cycle on December 21, 2012. A bland-looking gentleman on a cable news channel was discussing a topic I had only heard about recently myself. The end of the Mayan calendar on December 21, 2012. Some were calling it the end of the world. I had dismissed it the first time I heard about it. But that was probably because my mother had brought it up. I pretended to pay more attention to it now. Some say December 21 could mark the end of the world. Others say it's just a resetting back to start. Like an odometer on an old car that flips back to zero after 99,999.99 miles. The rose and olive-scented woman looked back at me and smiled.
See? Mischances, secrets, and regrets. When the end of the world does arrive, that's all that will be left. And cockroaches, of course.
She laughed heartily at her own joke, and I took the opportunity to jump up from my seat and start gathering my things.
So nice talking with you. I have to run now to catch my plane, I lied.
Twice. When I came out of the dimly lit airport bar, I blinked hard to adjust my eyes back to the light-filled terminal. I felt dizzy from the early morning drink and jumping up too fast from the airport bar stool. So I stood still for a few minutes trying to reacclimate and catch my ragged breath, while the row of television screens all flipped over in unison to announce breaking news and special alerts. I stood frozen in front of them, blinking and breathing. At first, all I could see on the screens were people crying. The tears seemed endless and oppressive. Standing nearest the first of a dozen screens that traveled down the airport corridor gave a Drossa effect to the images, and I felt my eyes crossing as I glanced down the corridor toward the gate, G12. For those first moments, I was removed from the event I was watching, like it was a faraway wave that could not reach me. And then, the wave changed course. It reached me after all. It crashed over me and took me with it, spinning me, taking my breath away, submerging me and releasing me, leaving me gasping in its wake. Flight 555. I was supposed to be on that plane. The thought rang through my brain, competing with static and nausea as I stared at the television images outside the airport bar I had just exited. I was tempted to look away, or to run away, but something kept my feet in place. Something kept me right where I was. A momentum of activity overtook the airport terminal I was still standing in. A low hum quickly escalated to a collective high-pitched shriek. I tuned it out. I tuned out everything but the corridor of televisions. The camera on the nearest screen panned on bits of twisted metal. Familiar, strangely. I stared at the blurry white words in the black bar across the bottom of the television screen, waiting for them to come back into focus, to confirm that what I had seen was correct. Eventually, my knees buckled underneath me and my vision faded slowly to black. I remember that the fall seemed long, and I even thought briefly about putting my hands out to brace myself to stop the fall, but I couldn't because my limbs were paralyzed. Just like that, my body was no longer my own. And as I fell, all I could see were the words scrolling across the bottom of the screen coming back into focus finally. Plane bound for Guatemala crashes on residential corner in Rock Harbor moments after takeoff. Mari.
My arms and legs and even my back are all numb, and yet I can tell the sheets are soft.
Strange.
I am so tired that I just cannot wake up.
Maybe it was the sleeping pills and wine cocktail I gave into finally last night, of all nights, I muse guiltily.
But maybe, just maybe, it was something else. Didn't Lou and I just have a conversation a few weeks ago about the world ending?
Perhaps it's happening, after all.
There's an odd beeping noise that taps out a rhythm that is quiet enough to start out as soothing, but quickly becomes annoying. I think about calling out to Lou to stop that racket, but I hear voices and none of them are Lou's.
That worries me. Is something wrong with Lou?
I start to feel really nervous and the beeping gets louder and faster and I hear more voices. Louder voices this time, and then I feel myself sink back into those so soft sheets. A calm feeling wraps around my brain and crowds out the other thoughts that are trying to step into my mind. So many people are fighting for priority in my memory reel now. Joe, Neri, Tomas, Mama, Ray. I keep them all out, and I think only about Lou. That night we talked about the end of the Mayan calendar. I had asked her what she would do if the world as we knew it was truly ending. And she surprised me with her answer. Perhaps that was the reason I failed to tell her what I would do.
What I did.
The voices become dimmer, and I strain to listen for Lou's voice, but it still isn't among them. The rhythm of the voices blends together to make a combined sound, making it impossible to pick out any single words. Save one.
Coma.
Lou. I came to outside an airport bathroom with a very concerned and official-looking man waving something under my nose while continuing to look over his shoulder like there was somewhere else he needed to be. I gagged a little and sat up. I felt some drool ooze out of the corner of my mouth and I wiped it with my fingers and then wiped my fingers in turn on my new linen pants. I imagined what my sister, Ray, would have said about this whole scene, if she were still alive. How very glamorous. I read the official-looking man's name tag and said, I'm okay, Eric, thank you. I started to stand up.
Miss, you need to wait here. There is a lot going on here this morning, and we are waiting for backup emergency personnel. Just wait here until we can get more help.
I stayed sitting and reached for my purse that had splayed open next to me, dumping a few items on the floor. When I found my phone inside my purse, I tapped some numbers and listened to a strange clicking noise on the other end. I started to stand again, while Eric the paramedic tried pushing me down again, his brow furrowed and his eyes distracted. I nodded at him, knowing full well that I would not be staying here at the airport. I needed to get home to Rock Harbor and check on my mother. I needed to know that Mari was all right.
Here, let me help you. Are you here with anyone?
Eric had given up pushing me back down to a sitting position and was now helping me stand, and also picking up some items that had fallen out of my purse. I shook my head slowly, testing how dizzy the movement made me feel. As Eric handed me my lip gloss and wallet, he held onto a slip of flimsy paper, his eyes darting from me to the paper and back again.
Miss?
I nodded my head at him, trying to answer the imminent question without words, as I had none right now.
Miss,
Is this your boarding pass? Were you supposed to be on?
I left the rest of his sentence hanging in the air as I turned abruptly, thinking I saw Mari coming out of the airport bar just then. It took only a half second to realize it wasn't Mari, of course, but the tweed-suited woman who had toasted to secrets and regrets and the end of the world with me just a few moments. Was it longer now? Ago.
Is she all right?
The woman who was not Mari ignored me and asked the paramedic directly as he nodded and shooed her away with the free hand that was not holding me up, but that was still holding onto my unused boarding pass. I turned away from the woman and gate G12, and I let Eric guide me back down to a sitting position on the airport floor as my legs were suddenly feeling quite weak. 1 month ago, Mari had invited me over for dinner. Not unheard of, but not a common event either in those last few months. Only a yard separated our dwelling spaces on Rock Harbor, but still we each kept to our own corners absent invitations. Mari said I didn't need to bring anything, but I brought a bottle of wine because I thought there was nothing I could bring that she would appreciate more. Ungrateful, probably. Also true. Mari had made steaks on the grill with a killer marinade. Between her invitations, I had this habit of forgetting what a great cook my mother was. We took our plates into the living room, walking past the kitchen and dining room, and I marveled as I did every time we did this, how we would never have been allowed to eat like this when we were kids. How Ray had missed out on this version of Mari. Barefoot, with loose jeans and her favorite bright red oversized knit sweater, Mari had settled into her favorite chair in the living room, with her feet tucked under her. Her still thick, still jet black hair was up in a messy bun, the lines of her dark olive skin fading in the soft light of the living room. In that light, her bloated, puffy face was only a slight distraction from her otherwise bohemian beauty. I could still imagine Mari as beautiful, even though I knew that a stranger on the street would not be able to look past the puffiness, bloat, red blotched face and lines and dark circles that aged Mari well past her 44 years, to see what I saw. While I could still make out some version of the younger Mari, I wished I didn't have all those barriers as well. "They say the world is ending," Mari had said as she cut into her steak, and I in turn had rolled my eyes at my mother's dramatic flair. "Not really. Just a little more than 3 months from today. December 21, 2012. The end of the Mayan calendar. It's right around the corner, niña." My mother almost never called me by my given name or my nickname. Her name for me always was little girl, niña, and I hated it. "Superstitious now, Mari?" I had taken to calling her by her first name out loud, and not just in my head, over the last few years to her grave dismay. I ignored her flinching as she always did when I called her Mari aloud. "I don't remember you ever being afraid of black cats or broken mirrors, Mari."
"What are you talking about, niña?"
Sometimes I forgot that for all her command of the English language, American sayings and shorthands still were sometimes lost on my mother, despite the fact that she had lived here for all of my life, over 23 years now. "Nothing. Tell me about the Mayan calendar. I have no idea what you are talking about." I settled into my steak and wine.
"Oh, it's silly, really," Mari conceded now.
My mother's voice had a melodic ring I remembered from my childhood. Sometimes I wished I could close my eyes and only hear her.
"Hadn't thought about it since I was a child, actually, but I saw a documentary on the news recently, and I thought, well, wouldn't that make sense? Wouldn't all the things that happened to me, to us, make more sense if the end of the old world was actually upon us, like the early Mayans had predicted?"
I sipped my wine and shook my head morbidly. Same song, different tune with my mother. With a dead husband, dead daughter, insatiable homesickness, and thirst for sleeping pills and Pinot Grigio, it was hard for her not to believe the world was ending every day. Now the world was ending because of a Mayan calendar.
"What would you do, niña?
My mother leaned forward and asked conspiratorially, "What would you do if the world as we know it really was ending?" I sipped my goblet of wine and said the first thing that came to my mind, incredible as it was. I'd travel, I guess. Go somewhere I've never been. Actually, that doesn't rule out very many places, does it? I had laughed then, and Mari hadn't. Ray was the one who had always talked about leaving Rock Harbor, not me. I had always wanted to stay behind, which is exactly what happened. Only now it felt all wrong. Mari stared at me long and hard as if she was just noticing something for the first time. Strangely, she did not show any surprise in my odd answer. "Well, why don't you then?" she replied. "Take a trip?"
"Yes." "What about finally going to see Guatemala? Your other homeland?
Besides Rock Harbor, of course.
You could even meet Sister Magdalena. I would write to her and tell her you are coming. She'd be overjoyed to meet you and talk to you."
Sister Magdalena. Somewhat of an urban legend in our home growing up, Sister Magdalena was head of the House of Mercy's orphanage outside Lake Atitlan in Guatemala, and the reason my mother had originally come to America some 24 years earlier. Apparently, Sister Magdalena had arranged for an American family to sponsor Mari and sent Mari here to New York to join the convent, to escape some trouble she had apparently gotten into in Guatemala. Trouble that had always been hinted at, but that Ray and I had never really been privy to. In my mind's eye, Sister Magdalena had always been the reason a motherless and wayward child, well, a 20-year-old is practically still a child, no? became my mother. It was Sister Magdalena who set the pieces in motion for Mari to meet the dashing, blue-eyed New York City firefighter from Rock Harbor named Joe Roselli, who became my father. It was all because of Sister Magdalena. It was all her fault, really, depending upon how you looked at it. But all that happened before the world had ended. Our world, that is. And now, everyone's world was ending? I was intrigued, but not fearful. And I had actually been rolling over the idea of taking a trip. I was still working out a plan to put my new social work degree to good use, but in the meantime, I remained paralyzed on Rock Harbor Island, the place I had hardly ever left in my entire lifetime, and never really intended to, until recently. Now that I had started to accept that Seamus wasn't worth sitting around pining away for. Seamus. God, that's a whole other story. And so, perhaps a bit despite my mother, and perhaps because in that moment I truly believed the world was ending, I had pulled up Expedia on my iPad and researched flights and hotel deals in Guatemala. What was the harm? I'd at least meet with the famous, infamous, Sister Magdalena. "You know what?" I said to Mari as I shut down my tablet. "That's a great idea. I'll tie up a few things and I'll fly to Guatemala in a few weeks." I sipped my wine dramatically while Mari continued staring at me, leaving her wine glass strangely untouched. "I'll finally see for myself the place we come from." As I stood up to leave after dinner that night, before I even had a chance to say goodbye, Mari got up and walked over to the old ornately carved secretary in the hallway foyer. She wrote down Sister Magdalena's contact information and handed it to me solemnly, sadly actually. Now I realize it was deep sadness in her voice, as she said, "I think this is such a great idea, Niña. You go to Sister Magdalena first when you arrive in Guatemala. She will tell you everything you need to know." After I finally escaped Eric, the zealous paramedic, and the commotion that was quickly overtaking the airport, it took me several hours to get home to Rock Harbor. There were police checkpoints and questions at every stop as I neared the island. "Yes, I live there," I repeated again and again, as I showed dubious officials my license through the taxi window. At the last checkpoint over the Rock Harbor Bridge, I showed a police officer my license yet again, and he shook his head and whistled long and low through his teeth. "Luna Roselli, you live there?" He pointed incredulously at the address on my license as if it was some kind of famous address. I nodded but still corrected him. I hated that I had been named for my dead maternal grandmother. Ray got the name that basically means sunshine, and I got dead grandma. Don't think she didn't constantly remind me of that fact. You know, back when she was alive. Actually, it's Lou. Everyone calls me Lou. Except Mari, who calls me Nina. I left that part out. You live alone? I was startled by the question as it wasn't as easy to answer as he probably believed. Oh, I live with Mari, my mother. I stumbled over how best to identify Mari, and then continued. Well, I live in the garage apartment behind her house. He paused a beat, and I felt a little uncomfortable then, because clearly the garage apartment was neither legal nor to code, and here I was admitting this all to a police officer, which I would never have done under ordinary circumstances. And so my mind started to wander. Did I just get Mari and me in trouble? The officer broke the uncomfortable silence, saying, Come on, I'll take you home. I wasn't sure why I needed to be taken home. Did he need to see for himself the illegal apartment so that he could write a citation? As it did so often, my mind flashed through 1,000 worst-case scenarios, including me locked up in zoning jail, which I immediately assumed was a real thing without questioning my imagination for a moment. Why do you always assume the worst is going to happen? Seamus had asked me that incredible question recently. We had been sitting at a red light, and I told him he should have left more room between us and the car in front of us. What if another car comes careening down the road behind you, Seamus? You hardly have enough room to move out of the way. Seamus had looked at me with genuine frustration as he asked me why I always think this way. I had kept all the possible and more specific responses locked behind gritted teeth, and instead had managed to spit out only, Don't you think after all that's happened to me, I'm entitled to at least that much?
Mari. I smell coffee now. Soft sheets, quiet voices, and the smell of coffee. This is my life now. Simple and sensory. I like it. I don't drink much coffee anymore, but I still enjoy the smell of fresh roasted coffee. I remember how much I hated bitter-tasting American coffee when I first came here, sent by Sister Magdalena after. Well, after everything happened back home. I found one coffee shop near the convent where I was living in Manhattan that had strong Guatemalan coffee, and I started frequenting it. Of course, I wasn't only there for the coffee. And one day, after I'd been going to the coffee shop for weeks, I was greeted particularly warmly. Oh, the gentleman who left before you actually paid for your coffee, miss. So there you go. The clerk, back then we called them clerks and not baristas, and my daughter Lou was always trying to break me off the clerk habit later on, handed me my now free coffee. I tried to smooth down the discomfort of having accepted a gift from a stranger. I looked over my shoulder and saw that the gentleman was actually waiting outside the coffee shop where I'd trip over him on my way out. So much for an anonymous show of chivalry. This gentleman clearly wanted to be thanked. I nodded at my coffee cup and at him on my way out, not slowing my stride one bit for fear I'd become locked in place. After all, I had noticed him almost daily. He always wore a dark blue shirt with a New York City Firehouse Company number on the left front pocket. He had blue eyes under a dark black crew cut that were more than a bit intoxicating. But I hadn't come to this country looking for intoxicating blue eyes. I hadn't come to this country looking for anything. I had instead come to this country to run from everything. I kept my pace as I rushed out the door past the fireman. Thank you, that was very kind of you, I said, without slowing down.
You're welcome,
he replied breathlessly as he hurried now to keep up with me down the sidewalk. We walked like that for half a block when suddenly the skies opened up and it started to rain. And I was left holding only a soggy to-go coffee cup. No umbrella in sight. Just then, the breathless man popped an oversized umbrella over my head and continued walking with long strides trying to keep pace with me, a feat made easier by the fact that I was now slowing down to stay under the umbrella's dry embrace. I glanced at him sideways
smiling and nodding again at him and the coffee cup repeatedly before stopping abruptly and looking into his eyes.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?